You're listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. Stay tuned for Arab Voices next.
Pacifica Radio.
Ana sauti Radio Pacifica,
al KPFT 90.1 FM,
Houston. Unasikiza 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Yawaz hai Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
Oh hi Pacifica Toy, kissing
se. Chaliye, aaj hum sab mil karke is dharti pe shanti ke liye prarthna kare.
Chúng tôi muốn nói lên sự thật cho giới lãnh đạo được biết. Chúng tôi là Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
一同向和平進發，我哋係侯司長嘅 Pacifica KPFT 90.1 FM 90.1.
Mimi ni Pacifica, uhuru wa mazungumzo kwa watu walio huru.
Hum taqat ke samne bhi sachai se bolte hain. Hum hain Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
Let's all get together and pray for the peace on earth.
من غير العدالة مش ممكن يوجد السلام.
Good evening and welcome to the Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. And if you're in Galveston, it's 89.5 FM. And of course, live broadcast on the internet at www.kpft.org. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices. Mark has the night off. Our guest tonight will be Dennis Holliday, former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and former UN Assistant Secretary General. We will discuss with him the transfer of power to the U.S.-appointed Iraqi interim government and what it means. We will also take your calls live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. But first, let's start with Arab Voices Community Calendar.
Hello, may I help you?
Hello, can I ask a few questions about the apartment you have on Park Street?
What was your name?
My name is Juan Hernandez.
It's been rented.
Oh, it's gone?
Hello?
Hello, my name is Sanjay Kumar. I am calling about the apartment on Park Street.
It's not available.
It's not available, but I just now saw it in the paper.
May I help you?
Hi, my name is Tyrone Washington. I'm calling about a place to rent on Park Street.
No longer available.
It's not available now.
Nope, sorry.
Okay.
Hello?
Yes, hello. My name is Graham Wellington. I'm calling about the apartment for rent on Park Street. Is that still available?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, really? I'd love to make an appointment.
Housing discrimination is illegal. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing, it's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
The Arab American Cultural and Community Center in Houston, the ACC, is offering free medical screening to the Houston community at large every Saturday from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Different doctors with various expertise will be providing this free screening at the ACC site located at 10555 Stancliffe Road. For more information, call the ACC at 832-351-3366. The award-winning film documentary Control Room is now playing in Houston. This special documentary was produced by Jihan Nujaim, an Arab-American film producer. This film documentary was shot in the Baghdad Control Room of Al Jazeera Satellite TV during the U.S. invasion and its destruction by the American airstrike. Control Room is now playing in Houston at the Angelica Film Center and Cafe in downtown Houston and at the landmark Greenway 3 Theater. Another film documentary called The Battle of Algiers is also playing at the Angelica Film Center and Cafe. This film covers the Algerian struggle for independence from the French in the late 1950s. Houston's TV Access Channel 17 on Time Warner Cable will broadcast a special speech for the late Dr. Edward Said this coming Tuesday, July 3rd at 7:30 p.m. On Sunday, July 11th at 10 p.m., Rabbi Esherman will be on Channel 17 talking about home demolitions in the occupied Palestinian territories. It will also broadcast again on July 24th at 9 a.m. Again, if you have access to Channel 17 on Time Warner Cable, then mark your calendar for speech by the late Dr. Edward Said to be broadcast on Tuesday, July 3rd at 7:30 p.m. And a discussion by Rabbi Esherman on home demolitions in the occupied Palestinian territories will be aired on July 11th at 10 p.m. and on July 24th at 9 a.m. A cultural event titled Expressions of Faith will be held on Saturday, August 7th at the Happy Center in the heart of the Theater District of downtown Houston. The cultural event will include an art show in the gallery with works from American Muslim artists along with performances on the main stage by American Muslim nasheed singers, rap artists, dramatic poets, spoken word poets, and comedians from around North America who display the richness and diversity of various Muslim cultures. Admission to the event is open to the public. For more information, visit www.expressionsoffaith.org.
Houston,
you are invited to attend the Freedom Mela Carnival on Saturday, July 3rd at the Houston Farm and Ranch Club between the hours of 3 p.m. and 12 a.m. There will be lots of South Asian, Arabic, and Persian food, music, dances, and songs. Bring your families. There will be a kids zone with pony rides, slides, moonwalks, and much, much more. For the big kids, there will be a gallery of sports cars. Entrance to the Mela is absolutely free of charge. This is a not-for-profit event, and there will be some very cool giveaways. Local talent is welcome. For booths, sponsorships, advertisement, and your talent, please call Tony at 713-539-3416. That's Tony at 713-539-3416. Our web address is www.desiconnectionsusa.com. That's www.desiconnectionusa.com. Remember, Saturday, July 3rd at the Houston Farm and Ranch Club, located on Highway 6 and Patterson, Road 3 to 12. This event is organized by Occasions. This is KPFT Houston.
Coming up next, Arab Voices News Summary. The Israeli occupation forces launched a large-scale military invasion of the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun yesterday, shooting at Palestinian civilians, injuring at least 21, and causing massive demolition of houses, public facilities, and infrastructure. Dozens of Israeli occupation tanks and armored bulldozers, backed by combat helicopters, invaded the town last night and started razing vast areas of arable lands and citrus plantations. The bulldozers also destroyed the main roads leading to and from the town, peeling off the asphalt layer and placing heaps of sand to block them. Ibrahim Hamad, the mayor of Beit Hanun, mentioned that the Israeli forces have been intentionally destroying the town's infrastructures, pointing out that the destruction reached streets, bridges, buildings, water, telephone, and sewage networks. In the Gaza Strip city of Khan Yunis, Israeli occupation forces demolished today two Palestinian houses owned by Ali and Talal Musleh, forcing all those inside out and rendering them homeless. In the nearby Al-Qarara town, it was reported that Israel preparing to demolish nine Palestinian homes. Since Saturday, Israeli Apache helicopters have been pounding missiles on a daily basis on the Gaza Strip, leaving massive destruction of property and commercial areas, killing and injuring several Palestinians. Hamas, in retaliation, fired rockets at an Israeli town near the border with Gaza, killing at least one person. On Sunday, the Israeli occupation army shot and killed an 11-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Ashorbaji, and 39-year-old Ashraf As-Sabbagh in the Gaza Strip. On Monday, Israel demolished 15 Palestinian homes and two multi-story buildings in the central Gaza city. The Palestinian Health Minister, Dr. Jawad Al-Tayebi, declared a few days ago that the West Bank city of Nablus is a catastrophic area, as it has been suffering sharp shortfalls of powder milk and food due to the ongoing Israeli incursion and strict military curfew by the Israeli army. Dr. Al-Tayebi said, quote, "The Israeli occupation forces blatantly contravene all the international norms and conventions, slamming all the humanitarian's values as it banned the International Red Cross Society to access the besieged areas and supply the children there with the needed milk and foodstuffs, despite what the IRCS has tried to do so several times, but in vain." Unquote. Dr. Al-Tayebi described the Israeli onslaught on the old town of Nablus, where it has been under strict siege for several days, in which the Israeli occupation troops ran amok insanely, shooting to kill the Palestinians, searching from house to house, demeaning the citizens, and using dynamite to explode the old ancient buildings, leaving behind several casualties. At least 10 Palestinians were murdered in Nablus over the past few days, and more than 70 were wounded by the Israeli occupation forces. The Israeli Supreme Court ordered today the Israeli occupation army to modify its plan of the route of the apartheid wall it's building on Palestinian land. The Israeli court cited that while the barrier could be justified for security reasons, the army was also bound to take into account the impact on residents. The court statement said, quote, "The additional margin of security achieved by the current path of the fence is not equal to the current path's additional infringement on the local inhabitants' rights and interests," unquote. It further said, quote, "The current balance between security considerations and humanitarian considerations is disproportionate." In response to the court's ruling, the Palestinian Prime Minister, Ahmed Qureya, said the barrier should be torn down and not only have its path altered. He said, quote, "It is not about changing the route or not. It's a wall, a separation wall which is being built on the Palestinian territories. It's a racist separation wall and therefore it should fall. There is no other alternative," unquote. The International Court of Justice, by the way, is expected to deliver an advisory ruling on the legality of this apartheid wall on July 9th. This apartheid wall will cost more than $3 billion and will stretch for 430 miles, mostly on stolen Palestinian land, dividing dozens of Palestinian villages and towns and destroying many Palestinian homes. For more detailed information on this wall, please visit www.stopthewall.org. A two-day UN conference on Palestinian rights opened in South Africa yesterday with a message from Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat saying Israel's pull-out plan from Gaza was in direct contrast of what was happening on the ground. Arafat said in his recorded message, quote, "Today Sharon is talking about a disengagement plan for Gaza while his actions on the ground reflect exactly the opposite." He also added, "Closures of our areas, arrests and killings are a daily and nightly occurrence. It gets bloodier every day." He called on conference delegates to, quote, "raise your voice and intervene to get Israel to stop its war and aggression on our people and to halt its economic siege and air raids on our cities, villages and refugee camps," unquote. The head of the UN nuclear watchdog, Mohammed al-Baradei, said on Sunday that Israel should start serious talks of ridding the Middle East of nuclear weapons and end nuclear imbalance in the region. He said, quote, "Israel agrees with that, but they say it has to be after peace agreements." He added, "My personal opinion is maybe we need to start to have a parallel dialogue on security at the same time when we are working on the peace process." Al-Baradei said everyone knew that Israel had a nuclear capability, even if Israel has always refused to admit this. Last December, Al-Baradei asked Israel to give up its secret arsenal of nuclear weapons so as to head off an arms race in the Middle East. He is due to travel to Israel next month to discuss making the Middle East a nuclear-free zone. The U.S.-appointed Iraq's interim government took legal custody of former President Saddam Hussein and 11 top members of his regime today from the U.S. occupation authority. It is expected that the former Iraqi president will be charged by a special Iraqi tribunal tomorrow. Despite the handover of power to the U.S.-appointed interim Iraqi government on Monday, U.S. Army officials announced today that about 5,674 former U.S. soldiers will be assigned to National Guard and Reserve units in Iraq and Afghanistan and are expected to serve for as long as 18 months. The U.S. Army currently has over 135,000 troops occupying Iraq. And immediately after the announcement was made of this transfer of power, a car bomb exploded outside a police headquarters where Japanese troops were deployed, wounding three policemen. At least 10 mortar rounds were fired earlier today at a U.S. base near Baghdad International Airport, wounding 11 U.S. soldiers. Mortar rounds were also fired at a U.S. base near Balad City, north of the capital, Baghdad. In other areas in Iraq, a car bomb exploded outside the headquarters of another police force in Samawa City, south of Baghdad, injuring two people. Yesterday, three U.S. Marines were killed and two wounded when their convoy was hit in a bomb attack in Baghdad. We will take a short break now, and when we come back, we will talk with Dennis Holliday, former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and former UN Assistant Secretary General. We will discuss with him the transfer of power to the U.S.-appointed Iraqi interim government and what it means. We will also take your calls live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT.
Missiles flying in the third world towards the people stranded on their knees. Bombs falling over Baghdad, killing children who are starving by degrees. There are those of us who'd question, what's the goal and what's the cost? 600,000 dead malnourished children, a UN-sanctioned holocaust. Missiles flying in the third world, from Hanoi to Wounded Knee. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and each one shouts, democracy. Contras, kings and generals, stars and stripes, from Rangoon to Los Angeles, selling oil, guns and crack pipes. Missiles flying in the third world, and each one will kill a child. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and hunger and death is running wild. We had to destroy the village
to the Arab Voices on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 FM in Galveston, and live broadcast on the internet at kpft.org. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices. Mark has the night off. With us now live over the phone from New York is Dennis Holliday, former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and former UN Assistant Secretary General. Mr. Holliday has been with the United Nations for 34 years prior to his resignation. He held several positions while at the United Nations, including the Assistant Secretary General for Human Resources Management of the UN, and also as the UNDP Regional Representative in Thailand and Director of the Division of Personnel at the UN's Development Program. He has spent most of his long career with the United Nations in development and humanitarian assistance-related posts, both in New York and overseas. Mr. Holliday, welcome back to Arab Voices.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be on your air again.
Thank you very much. Obviously, the first question we would like to ask you is, what is your opinion on the transfer of power that the United States did on Monday to the U.S.-appointed interim Iraqi government?
Well, the timing clearly caught us all off balance, but with hindsight it makes a lot of sense in that Mr. Bremer clearly wanted to leave the country in one piece, but a very strange way to handle a major significant step towards true sovereignty, because this is obviously not sovereignty. This is just a move in the right direction, perhaps. But to do that secretly is very strange. However, let's hope the Iraqi people will tolerate what's happened. They'll accept this appointed group of men and women who have been approved by the United States, and that they'll give them 6 months to put together the election material, and that elections indeed will take place, which will give then Iraq representative government and a chance to look and rework that constitution, and perhaps rework those edicts that Mr. Bremer left behind when he departed at the beginning of this week.
Now, that election is obviously set for January 2005. Between now and the January deadline for the elections, what kind of sovereignty do you see that the Iraqis would really have?
Well, right now,
while the U.S. still maintains 135,000+ soldiers on the ground.
Yes, they effectively have no sovereignty. I think the transfer of Saddam Hussein is just a gesture. Today, I just heard on the news the Americans bombed Fallujah, for example. I mean, this is not sovereignty. This is a country that is heavily occupied by 160,000 alien troops. About 120,000 or so are Americans. I think that's what you said. So this is a game that's being played by Mr. Bush to try to make him look better, to hope that the responsibility for continuing violence will not be laid at his door in the White House. He's looking for re-election, after all. Frankly, I don't think this is workable. I think that it's going to be very difficult for the new interim government appointed by the Americans to get the confidence of the Iraqi people. But, you know, I want to be optimistic. Let's hope that they can make it work for 6 months.
Now, that is what's going to be exactly my next point, where a lot of people want to make this work. They want to make the situation in Iraq better. Obviously, there is an occupation. Everybody wants the occupation to end of Iraq. They do want the Iraqi people to have sovereign, true sovereign nation and control of their own country, and really from A to Z, not just, you know, in paperwork in front of some kind of a mandated or controlled TV and media. What do you think? How could this be possible? What is the next step?
Well, the next step, ideally, would be that tomorrow the Americans would withdraw their occupation. I mean, that clearly is the only real solution to this this crisis of confidence and the lack of real sovereignty. And I think if the Americans were to leave Iraq, then I believe that those who entered Iraq in the last, 12, 18 months resist the American presence and to attack the American presence, they also hopefully would leave Iraq also, which would then give the Iraqis a chance to work out their own arrangements to establish their points of unity, and there are many, and to establish their differences and then begin the task of resolving those differences. That, I believe, they will have difficulty doing while they've got 160,000 foreign troops looking over their shoulder.
Now, realistically, you've mentioned that for the U.S. and the occupation to end, and sometimes we, you know, when I think about that myself, if the U.S. decides to withdraw now from Iraq, do you think all the fightings in there will end, will stop, and people, whoever attacks, whoever that will cease, and things will be normal?
Mm-hmm.
Is the interim government now really have any respect from the Iraqi people that things will be normal, or would that be more chaos?
Well, you know, I don't have the answer to your question, but I can give you my view, and my view is that we now have a resistance movement in Iraq, which would seem to include, 60, 70, 80% of the population. I think the Americans have made so many mistakes. They failed so badly after the invasion to settle the basic needs of the Iraqi people, and I talk of jobs and housing and water systems and electric power, that they are now resented extensively throughout the country. So you've got the vast majority of Iraqis are opposed to the occupation. Many are clearly in some form of resistance or other. But on top of that, you then got these external forces that came in when the army was disbanded by Bremer and when the border guards were taken away. And they're in there with a different agenda. It's not an Iraqi agenda, in my view. It's their own agenda of retaliation against the Americans for the damage they've done in the Middle East, the killing of the Palestinians by the Israelis, which are clearly American-supported, the attacks on Afghanistan, and of course now recently Iraq. So my view is if you can get the Americans out, then those who came in to hit the Americans will go with them. and then the resistance against the Americans will presumably disappear when the Americans have gone. And that allows the Iraqis to face up to their own difficulties and begin the difficult task of resolving those difficulties starting now. But I think it won't really get off the ground until we have a new, properly elected representative government.
And we know that the U.S. credibility has been weakened big time with the invasion and occupation of Iraq and the treatment of the prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison. Let me ask you this question. I know you've just came to the United States from Europe. What is the feeling there in Europe about the transfer of power and the whole Iraqi situation and so on?
I think I just came from Ireland, and you know, the Irish have close relations with the United States. Many millions of Irish people moved to the United States in the last 100 years or so. Now, even under those conditions, I think the feeling of unhappiness with U.S. policy, the contempt for Mr. Bush and his aggression, his active aggression in breach of international law, his disregard for the United Nations, his misjudgments, but also the inaccuracy of the presentations for justifying this. All of this put this together with the use of Shannon Airport in the south for flying military aircraft into Kuwait and into Iraq. This turned the Irish people completely against the Washington regime of Bush. And our own government has paid the price for supporting Bush already in local elections. And he got a very uncomfortable welcome in Ireland, and quite rightly so. And the Irish people felt properly, I think, required to stand up and be counted in their protest as to his abuse of international law and the United Nations in particular. And, of course, the killing of over 10,000 innocent civilians in Iraq. These are war crimes. And I think the Irish people would like to see those settled properly.
You mentioned the 10,000 Iraqis who were killed in Iraq. Let me mention some statistics here, fresh statistics that were released actually last week by the Institute for Policy Studies, based here in Washington, D.C. It is called Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War. That study by the Institute for Policy Study and Foreign Policy in Focus, it shows that the number of coalition military deaths between the start of the war and June 16th of this year is 952. That includes 853 U.S. soldiers. The number of U.S. troops wounded in combat since the war began is more than 5,100 U.S. soldiers. Non-combat incidents are estimated to be over 11,000 injuries. The number of civilian contractors, missionaries, and civilian workers killed is estimated at 90. The Iraqi civilian killed is estimated between 9,500 and 11,300. Iraqi civilians injured is estimated at 40,000 people.
My goodness, yes.
And so far it says that the bill for this war has surpassed $126 billion, billion with a B. Of course, this is from our tax dollars. And actually, that's a very huge, large, detailed report of facts and statistics. It is a very costly war, not just in terms of money, obviously, the lives of the Iraqis, the civilians, the lives of the U.S. soldiers who are there, and so on. I want to remind our listeners of the phone number because we are taking calls live. That number is 713-526-5738. Again, it's 713-526-KPFT. And we are talking with Dennis Holliday, the former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and the former UN Assistant Secretary General. Let me ask you, Mr. Holliday, a question on the situation of the Iraqi people now in terms of their daily life. Obviously, it's a very scary time with the violence increasing and the attacks increasing there. Are they managing? Do they have the necessary food and water and milk and everything that they need to have in order to survive there?
No, I believe the answer is no. I mean, the fact is that families are keeping their children at home. The students are dropping out of the university. Younger children are not going to high school and primary school because they're afraid. The mothers and fathers are simply afraid to let their children out of the house. It's just too dangerous. The unemployment rate continues, I believe, to be 60 to 70%. So income to many homes is simply not there. the Oil for Food program has terminated. So I don't know whether, how they're managing, where they're getting their basic needs from. The condition of housing in many parts of Baghdad and other cities is extremely poor. Agriculture is still way under the levels of production required, and that's not helped, of course, by the lack of electricity, which the Americans have failed to restore, nor the fact that the pumps, the fuel, and all the other needs for agriculture and imported seeds and fertilizer, which is no longer produced in Iraq due to sanctions and the bombing of the Americans in the first and then now the recent invasion, is not there. So it's a very, very bad situation, and I think the Iraqis have lost their patience. I think this failure by the United States to repair the damage of the first Gulf War, and now the invasion recently by Mr. Bush of the infrastructure, power and water and so on, has simply turned every single Iraqi into a resistance fighter of some form or another. And it just simply adds up to the bottom line, which is the United States needs to get out of Iraq very quickly. And then the Iraqis need to get their own government together and then ask, if they wish, to ask for assistance from the international community, the United Nations or whatever. But clearly the UN has no role. As of now, the UN cannot collaborate further with the United States' illegal occupation.
Let me ask a question. This was actually brought up by a caller last week regarding the situation in Iraq. You visited Iraq before, correct?
Many times, yes.
Many times.
I was there just a couple of weeks before Mr. Bush invaded.
Exactly. And the question was, and several people say that, and it's repeated frequently on the mainstream media, the Fox News and the so many other channels out there, that Iraqis now have electricity. Iraqis now can go to schools. Iraqis now have universities. Leaving the impression that they never had electricity, they never had education, they never had infrastructure.
Yeah,
tell
right.
us more about what you've witnessed.
Well, there was an American writer on the television tonight who announced that for the first time the Iraqis now have an education system. I mean, this is rubbish. Back in the 1980s, UNESCO awarded Iraq a prize for the high standard of primary, secondary, and tertiary education. They were recognized by the World Health Organization as having put together a health care system throughout the country, both rural and urban areas, which was far beyond the standards in the rest of the Middle East. I mean, Iraq has been a model in many areas of development and growth. I mean, the tragedy, as we all know, is that at the same time, oil revenues went into military capacity. It led, unfortunately, to the acceptance of Saddam Hussein of the role of taking on the Iranians, when in fact the Americans really wanted that war themselves. So many mistakes were made on the negative side. But the standard of living, employment opportunities, housing, education in the country overseas were extraordinary. And this is all somehow being forgotten. And I noticed that those who were speaking on Fox and other places, for example, have completely forgotten about the sanctions. So when they arrived in Iraq and they were surprised to find poor conditions, they blamed Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, having forgotten that 12 years of sanctions were in place, during which we, the United Nations, not just destroyed the country, but we destroyed the social fabric of the country. We drove many, many Iraqis out of the country, and we killed thousands of innocent children every month through our inability to repair, unwillingness of the Security Council to repair power and water systems. And these children have died from waterborne disease, together with malnutrition, anemia, and other problems of health and conditions of living.
And since the U.S. government and the U.S. occupation took control of Iraq in March of last year, how is the situation now? Is it getting better slowly?
No,
is it getting worse?
It has deteriorated in some areas, and I don't believe it's improved much elsewhere. I mean, you see articles on the fact that U.S. troops are very kindly painting schools and other nice things like that. But, you know, that's not what's required. I mean, I've been to many of these schools. There are about 10,000. Primary schools, I think, in Iraq, and another 10,000 secondary schools. They need much more than paint. They need books. They need all the materials of education. They need toilets and proper facilities like that. And they need the restoration of the feeding programs, breakfast and lunch that the Ba'ath Party used to provide. So this was a first-class system. It needs restoration. And it needs the confidence of parents that there are teachers. Something like 10 or 15,000 teachers have been lost during the sanctions period. There's a huge amount of work to be done here. And it needs to be done with security. And that, of course, is, as we know, is sadly missing right now.
All right. And you're listening to the Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM in Galveston, and, of course, live broadcast on the Internet, from anywhere else on planet Earth at www.kpft.org. This is Saeed, producer and host of the show, with us now, and has been with us for the past few minutes, Mr. Dennis Holliday, former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and former UN Assistant Secretary General. The phone number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. We have several callers on hold. Actually, our queue is full right now, so we are going to take some of your calls live on the air. Let's go take our first caller, and that's Kirk. Kirk, you're in there.
Hi. I agree with most of the things that you've been saying, but you said earlier that you think that the U.S. troops should leave as soon as possible, as in right now. And I suspect, knowing the tensions between the various factions there, that we would likely end up with a civil war inside Iraq. And how do you expect to deal with that, especially, particularly from the Kurds, you know, who have spent a long time, they spent, what, 12 years now in a relatively independent space, and uncontrolled by the central government in Iraq, you know, supported by the U.S. I don't think the Kurds are going to just, like, you know, especially if we left today, I don't think that I think we would likely spark a civil war, probably with the Kurds initially.
Okay, thanks, Kirk, for your call.
Thank you.
Saeed, do you want me to respond?
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, clearly many people overseas worry about a civil war in Iraq. My Iraqi friends don't feel this is going to happen, and I agree with them. I think that the there are so many common aspects of life in Iraq, whether they're Kurdish or some other ethnic group, or whether they're Sunni or Shia or whatever, there's an Iraqi sense, I think, of belonging and honor and dignity and nationalist feeling that will bring these people together. And the Kurds themselves know perfectly well that the Turks, nor the Iranians, nor the Americans, nor the British, for that matter, never mind the Syrians and others, will not allow an independent Kurdistan. It may have been justified, it was justified, perhaps back in the end of the First World War, but sadly that opportunity was missed, thanks to Mr. Churchill. So I don't think that's going to happen. So I think the Kurds know perfectly well that their future rests within the greater Iraq. The Shia in the south certainly deserve to participate and lead, I would think, some sort of democratic, more representative government early next year. They have the numbers and they have the interest, and I think we'll see that. And I think hopefully we'll see a national coalition. I don't think we'll see civil war. I think Iraqis are far too smart. They're far too concerned about their country and the future of their country and the needs of their children and the next generation to start fighting each other. And I think the sooner we get the Americans out and the foreign terrorists out, if that's the word one should use, I don't know, then I think we'll see the Iraqis getting their act together and working as one. It won't be easy. I'm not saying there won't be difficulties, but it can happen, in my view.
All right, 713-526-5738 is the number. Give us a call if you have any questions for Mr. Dennis Holliday, the former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and former UN Assistant Secretary General. Our next caller is Lee. Lee, you're on there.
Hi, Dennis, this is Lee Lowe. I did the Iraq Notebook.
Oh, yes.
And nice to have you on the line.
Thank you.
And the question I had is, I heard an Iraqi woman, I think she's with some women's organization in Iraq, and she, of course, was very concerned that there weren't women in the government. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that they needed to have a separation of church and state. And she was very concerned that that would not happen. And I just wondered what your feelings are about that.
No, I realize there are people in Iraq, certainly the Christian community undoubtedly, and perhaps many of the Sunnis who feel concerned that the secular nature of Iraq will be lost and there will be a democracy perhaps, but a sort of a right-wing fundamentalist democracy. I'm not sure that is necessarily true. I think the Ayatollah Sistani has made very wise statements, and he does not seem to feel or require that Sharia law, for example, be introduced. It looks like he's prepared to support a modern democracy, representative government, with, I dare say, a Shia majority and some balance between the various communities of Iraq. So I'm sort of optimistic that with men like that in the country, and there are others who are equally wise and balanced, I think the Iraqis will be able to make all of their individual, all of their communities, you know, comfortable and at home. It's, as I said before, it's obviously not going to be easy, but the sooner we get out of there and we leave this country,
right, I agree with
to
that.
Those who own it and return their sovereignty in full, which of course has hardly begun, yeah, that's the sooner it's done, the better it will be.
All right, thank you, Lee, for your call.
Thank you.
All right, we have lots of callers online, on hold. That's great news. So we are going to take as many as we can for the next 15 minutes or so. Our next caller is Ahmed. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
Yes, sorry, I have one quick question.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, did you receive that information pertaining to Farrakhan and his comments on Palestinians in the Middle East? Did you read it?
Are you asking me?
Right. Yes.
I receive a lot of in the mail, so I have not had a chance to read that stuff.
Okay.
What is your question for Mr. Holiday about the Iraqi situation?
Okay. Well, I have a comment as far as that that's going on in Iraq, as well as with the Palestinians.
Okay.
And
go ahead.
Has a lot to do with the so-called Jews in Israel and what they're doing, and it's all about setting up proxy governments, just like they did when. The European nations, Caucasian European nations, assassinated Anwar Sadat, and now we see that Egypt is an ally, and they all of them are sitting back and letting Israel do what they're doing to the Palestinians, and that's the same thing that we're seeing with Iraq now, with they having a CIA member as in charge of Iraq, so it's just a proxy government, and all that has to do with the Palestinians' land and those so-called Jews. And the protection of all those Caucasian devils over there. That's it.
Well, I'm not sure about your wordings of the Caucasian as if they are responsible for that. The way you're labeling it here does not sound right. Mr. Holiday, what is your comment on that?
I must say, Saeed, I had great difficulty hearing all of that. But,
okay.
I mean, I think if Ahmed is talking about the presence of Israel and the Palestinian plight and the genocide taking place there, the state terrorism of Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians is something we all have to focus upon. Clearly, in my recent visits to the Middle East, to Cairo and so on, late last year, the Palestinian issue is still forefront in the minds of, I think, most people in the Middle East. And the link to Iraq is quite obvious. And the linkage of support that the Americans are providing for Israel and its appalling attacks on the civilians, civilian Palestinians, is tragic. And the involvement of the United States in Iraq, the military presence there, which I fear they may hope to keep longer than the Iraqis want them to be there, clearly is linked to the whole issue of Israel and Palestine. So we have a huge problem here. But I think tonight's program, we were trying to focus on resolving Iraq and returning Iraq to its former strength in the region. And then it's clearly, it and others will hopefully continue to play a greater part, however, in resolving the Israeli-Palestinian problem.
Correct. All right, let's move forward to other callers on hold. The next one is Larry. Larry, you're on there.
Yes, Saeed, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I want to return just for a moment to the oil for food program, since Mr. Halliday's definitely an expert witness to that. You know, there's a right wing, and in fact, Bill Clinton made the same argument in an interview with Amy Goodman, that Saddam basically was given more than enough money to take care of Iraq and that it was his decision not to. Mr. Holliday, I just wanted you to try and debunk that myth, because as I remember, the content of the sanctions as put forth by the UN resolution was much more prohibitive for many things to even arrive into Iraq to try and rebuild the infrastructure. And I just wanted to revisit that for a few minutes, and I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, on the last issue, let me address that first. There was no room for development activity or capital investment during the entire sanctions period. I have a development background myself, so my instinct was to get resources to rebuild electric power, water systems, sewage systems, housing, education, healthcare, and none of that was possible under oil for food. The way it worked was that the Iraqis were allowed to sell a certain amount of oil, the revenue for which went straight into the accounts of the United Nations. At the same time, Iraq was out seeking bids internationally for food commodities and also pharmaceutical commodities and certain equipment for irrigation, for education, for healthcare. These bids were then accepted or not accepted by Iraq, submitted to the United Nations in New York, and the Security Council 661 Committee approved or did not approve. And many times they played games, sad to say, with the humanitarian needs of Iraq, but the basic foodstuffs normally went through. And as of the middle of 97, when I arrived, the foodstuffs began to arrive at that stage. What I realized within several weeks of being there was that we were totally underfunded. Although we had something like $4 billion gross from oil sales, the net was about $2.5 billion, and this clearly didn't begin to address the needs of a population whose calorific intake had fallen below 1,000 per day. And we had no animal proteins in that diet, all sorts of missing vitamins, minerals, and other essential foodstuffs. So this was a very shabby program. It didn't really address the issues, and it took some time to double that program from 4 to 10 billion about 6 months after I arrived in that country. Nevertheless, we still maintained a population with 70% anemia among adults, high levels of chronic and ongoing malnutrition amongst children and others in the population. We have created what we call a sanctions generation of stunted people who are physically and mentally slightly impaired. I mean, I don't want to imply that thousands of Iraqis are mentally retarded. That's not correct. But attention span and other learning issues like that have been created by the sanctions and the neglect of the United Nations and the Security Council in particular. I mean, that's why some of us have labeled sanctions after 12 years genocidal, because intentionally the Council of the United Nations sustained sanctions in the full knowledge of the human catastrophe that they were creating.
All right, let's take another call from our listeners. Next one on hold is Cliff. Cliff, you're on there.
Yeah, I had a question, actually a couple, but the first one is that during Saddam Hussein's regime, what was the reason that the United Nations and all the different countries were involved subsidizing the food needs of the people of Iraq during his administration? Why was Saddam Hussein not capable, or so, you know, where did the money that he had, where did it go? Because obviously it didn't go towards foodstuffs for the people.
Well, so in the 70s and 80s, the oil revenues into Iraq grew to something like $30 billion a year, and that's 70-80s dollar values. That money was used very well by the Ba'ath Party in regard to education, healthcare, employment, housing, all the basic human rights and human needs. And as I said before, at the same time, unfortunately, the Ba'ath Party spent a fortune equally on weapons and military capacities. I mean, that was the problem. When we then had the first sanctions imposed after the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, Iraq was importing 70% of its foodstuffs at that time. Having allowed themselves to become very much dependent on oil revenues and the purchasing power of that revenue. Thus, the sanctions immediately closed down overseas bank accounts, all access to hard currency, thereby denying the government of Saddam Hussein any access to purchasing power. And the borders were sealed tight by the Americans and British in particular, and by the UN system. So they were cut off in terms of all exports and all imports. And exports did not begin again until 97, as I said, when the Oil for Food program was put together. So you can imagine the collapse of well-being and the loss of human rights during that first 5-6 years of the sanctions period.
Okay, thank you, Cliff, for your call. Let's try to take the remaining callers on hold with the remaining 5 minutes of the show. The next one on hold is Michelle. Michelle, you're on there.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a couple of fact questions. Is it not true that in Iraq, America set up 4 permanent military bases?
Well, I'm not sure about 4. I dare say you're absolutely correct. I know I was informed today that one has been established at Ur. That's an old Iraqi air base. Habani is another one, the international airport in Baghdad itself. So I think the United States is digging in, unfortunately, to have a military capacity for the next, well, the Koreans have now tolerated, 55 years?
Right, and then we pulled out Saudi Arabia
and the Iraqis
after we began the war,
tolerate.
Right?
Yes, the Saudis have problems also. So let's assume the Iraqis will not tolerate an American presence, and I believe that will be the case. And they
well, that was my question. What are the chances of someone of this country allowing us, you know, it'll be a cold day in the Middle East before this country will allow an evacuation?
Well, I think we are going to then look at a second Vietnam. I think the Iraqis are not going to accept American presence much longer, and I think by this time next year, we would, I think, have a massive resistance movement if the United States doesn't have the good sense to remove itself.
All right. Thanks, Michelle, for your call. Our next caller is Andre. Andre, you're on there.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
Just like last caller, I had a concern because I think the Americans are digging pretty deep in there. And my question was is that even if the Americans or the UN or British or other forces there pull out, don't you feel that there are other saboteurs or things that they would put in place, meaning they, meaning the Americans or powers that want to be there, would say, okay, yes, we left, now we're gone, but look what's happening. They have saboteurs there to try to keep up chaos so they can say, okay, now we need your help again. Or do you see that coming forth, or do you think the Iraqis are powerful enough to keep those type of things at bay?
Well, that's a very sinister impression you've just made, and I hope you're not going to be proven to be correct, but let's hope the United States won't play those games. I think the U.S. understands now that it has been rejected globally, and it's being held as a pariah now in Europe and in most of the world for the Iraqi invasion, the acts of aggression which are in breach of international law, the abuse of the United Nations. So I hope that the present government in Washington or the next one will learn that the importance of respecting international law and will be obliged under pressures to remove their troops, by this time next year, if not before. We have to be optimistic. I know you've raised some points and concerns that we perhaps all have, but let's be optimistic, and let's, I think, accept that the Iraqis will not tolerate an occupation any one day longer than they must.
Okay, let's take our last caller for the night, and I'm sorry I won't be able to take more than one, although we have several still on hold. Let's take Joseph. Joseph, you're in there.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for giving me the last chance. Appreciate that. And I would like to ask your guest two questions with the same scale.
Let's make it one because of the time.
Right. From the scale from 1 to 10, how much puppet is the United Nations of the U.S. government, and also how much shame the members of the United Nations Council feel themselves? On a scale from 1 to 10, how much puppet and how much shame they feel?
Okay, thanks for your call.
It's a very strange question, but I think in terms of puppet qualities, I would say it has to be 7. And in terms of shame for what they've done, I think it's very low, because they just won't accept the fact that they've committed war crimes, that they've allowed genocide to unfold in Iraq. They won't take responsibility for it. So I think that's a low figure. So it sounds bizarre, but that would be my reading.
All right, we're nearing the top of the hour. So again, I want to say sorry for the remaining callers on hold. We can't take your calls. Mr. Haldi, give us a last thought in the next 30 seconds or so about this situation.
Well, I wish I had some pearls of wisdom, but I think we need to be optimistic. We have to hope that the Iraqis would be patient with this puppet interim government they've now got in Iraq, that they will push for the elections that are their due at the end of the year, beginning of next year, and that they will then get their act together in terms of working together, have a representative government, perhaps a national coalition in the early years, and then redo that constitution so it works for Iraq and break down the edicts that Mr. Bremer has left behind again. It to serve the best interests of the Iraqi people. They so much deserve to have a proper life restored to them after these terrible years of war and sanctions.
Okay, and I want to tell our listeners that for you, for those who need to listen more to Mr. Dennis Haldi, don't forget to tune in this coming Sunday at 6 p.m. right here on KPFT 90.1 FM. To the Sunday Monitor, there will be more interviews with Dennis Haldi. This is this coming Sunday at 6 p.m. right here on KPFT 90.1 FM. More interviews with Dennis Haldi. Mr. Haldi, the former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and former UN Assistant Secretary General, has been our guest tonight. Thank you, Mr. Haldi, so much.
Thank you very much for having me, and I hope I've tried to throw some light. But